We're good, and we're continuing our studies in the book of Daniel. And the last couple times we were together, we saw in the seventh chapter where there's a big change in the book from chapter 7 on. What God is now doing is giving direct visions to Daniel. As he's seeing these visions at the end of the seventh chapter, he says in verse 28, "Hitherto, Daniel 7:28 is the end of the matter. And as for me, Daniel, my cogitations, the thing I was thinking on that I heard, troubled me, much troubled me. And my countenance changed in me." Got a little maybe ill there. But I kept the matter in my heart. I had to think about it. And you know, the thing about Daniel, God's going to continue now. And he's going to give him another vision here in chapter 8. 2 years after the vision of chapter 7, but you know, you think about it and you kind of feel for Daniel in this manner. You know, Daniel was a good Jewish boy. We read in the beginning of the book in chapter 1, yes, he was carried off to Babylon, but he had purposed in his heart that he was going to stay a good, faithful Jewish boy, even in the midst of a strange land. And he wasn't going to defile himself with the manners of the Babylonians around him. He wanted to stay true to his heritage. And he was a boy that had grown up in the temple. And he had heard the great words of God found not only in the law of Moses and in the Psalms, but even the book of Isaiah. And I'll bet Isaiah was a great book to rejoice Daniel when he was growing up. I mean, that book was written a little before the time he grew up, and he's hearing these great things, and he's thinking on Isaiah. He lived in a great time. He lived in the time of Uzziah and Jotham and Hezekiah, and the priests were at the temple, and he got these visions of God high and lifted up in chapter 6. And he got the revelations that I've read, and God revealing himself and talking about the Messiah, the Christ. He'll be born of a virgin. He'll be wonderful. He'll be counselor. He'll be the mighty God. He's to the ends of the earth. And you read all this great stuff in Isaiah about the Christ. And these are the revelations being given to Isaiah all about the Messiah and the Christ. And now here's Daniel in a strange land, and he's getting revelations, and he's getting visions. And he's not excited. He's troubled over them. Why? Because his are about the Antichrist. He's getting prophecies about the Antichrist. It had to be difficult for Daniel. You know, why couldn't I be like Isaiah? I mean, Daniel, it could be like, I'm thinking of a song by Steely Dan, you know, and they call the prophet Isaiah the Crimson Tide because he gets all this stuff about the Messiah, and they call me Deacon Blues. I'm getting all this difficult stuff here. Why am I getting all this stuff? And the reason is God wants us to see the full picture. God wants us to know the truth. Yes, there is a Messiah. There is a God, Virginia, in heaven. There is all that good news. But God wants us to, he wants to pull back the veil and show us, and there is an enemy. And there is the spirit of Antichrist. And there is a devil. And Daniel, you're living at the time with the captivity all around you. And you need to know how and where did this come from. And I'm going to show you, Daniel, how long it's going to last. And I have a plan for you. The thoughts I have for you are toward peace and an expected end of all this trouble, but I have to show it to you, and I need you to write it down, because your prophecies are going to get my people through the times of trial before the first, after the first, and before the second coming. And these things are all written. So what we're going to see in this chapter, there's going to open with the prophet in verse 1 and 2. And then there's going to give him the vision to Daniel in verses 3 through 12. And then what's going to happen is there's going to be a voices that he's going to hear in verses 13 and 14. And then there's going to be the visitation of the angel Gabriel in verses 15 and 16. And finally, he's going to be given the interpretation by the angel Gabriel. And I thought this was interesting too. Like so much of the book of Revelation, when you read through it, John says, "And I saw the angel, and the angel visited me, and the angel blew the trumpet." Now in the book of Isaiah, you've got God directly talking about his son. But when it comes to the Antichrist and the trouble, he's sending a messenger, an angel, with it. He's not directly, not that he's not revealing it, but he's revealing it to an angel and say, "Here, you can run with this message." But when it comes to the message about me and my son, I'd like to personally give this to people. And the truth is, when to have that relationship with Christ, we're getting a direct personal message from God. But when it comes to some of the bad stuff, you almost need a mediator. I'm afraid I've been elected your mediator for this stuff. And I've got to give you some of this bad stuff that maybe reading on your own you wouldn't understand. But God uses an angel of the church, a messenger here in the church, to explain these things to you. And God now here, what he's going to do, after the seventh chapter and the revelation that the times of the Gentiles and all those kingdoms are like big wicked beasts, a lion and a bear and a leopard and a dragon, and it troubled you so much, I want to move forward, verse 1, and in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, you needed 2 years to digest that last message, Daniel, but now that it's 2 years later, I'm going to give you another vision. And Daniel says, "The vision appeared to me," even to me, Daniel, "after that which appeared unto me at the first." God waited 2 years before I was ready for more of this message. And sometimes when it comes to certain things in the Bible, we need a little time to digest it and to think on it. We're not going to get it right away. And I don't know about you, but in my studies, it's worked that way. It's taken time for me to get things. God doesn't give it to me all at once. He lets me move along in March, and then maybe in April or May, he'll give me a little more and then a little further, and then he waits time for me. And Daniel says, verse 2, "And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in this vision, and I was by the river of Ulai." And he's laying out, the prophet is laying out, that God chose a particular place to give the vision to him. It needed to be the right time and the right place. And Daniel, doing day by day what he is told to do by God, finds himself in the right time and in the right place. Tonight, you're here at the right time. It's the midweek prayer meeting and Bible study. You're in the right place. This is the place where God wants to speak to you. God can give you visions for your heart when you're in the right time in the right place. Historically, Daniel is at Shushan. Shushan is the palace of the Medo-Persians, about 250 miles east of where Babylon was. And we know that what happened at the end of the fifth chapter is the Persians had taken over Babylon and they moved the capital east to Shushan, and Daniel was there. And I gave you some references in Nehemiah and Esther, and you can see, because those two books are at the time of the Persian world empire, and the palace is in Shushan. And Daniel is given this vision, which interestingly was by the river. The water of the word is likened. If you want visions, you got to stay close to the water of the word. That's the key. Anyways, the first thing, we get the prophet in the place. Now we're going to get the actual vision. What did you see, Daniel? Well, verse 3, "I lifted up my eyes and I saw." I mean, God made it clear as day. I mean, this is a vision given by God speaking to one of his prophets for the prophet to write this vision down clearly for all the readers afterwards. "I saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher horn," implied, "came up last. And I saw this ram, it was pushing westward and northward and southward. so that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. If the ram decided to take a particular piece of property, nothing could stop him from trampling on that property and taking it under his control. A verse, end of the verse. He did according to his will, and the ram became great. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and he touched not the ground. And the goat that I saw had a notable horn between his eyes, and he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing before the river. And he, ram, that be the he-goat, ran into him, the ram, in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close to the ram, and he was moved with choler, a bitter anger against him, and smote the ram and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, this he-goat. But the he-goat cast him, the ram, down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And therefore the he-goat waxed very great. And so he's given this vision here of a ram and a he-goat. Now, you wonder what's going on later on. If you go to verses 20 and 21, God will give you the interpretation right within the chapter. And so often when symbolism and imagery is used in the Bible, within a chapter or two, you'll find what it means. Oh, you want to know what the candlesticks are? They're the churches, Jesus said. You want to know what the stars are? They're the angels. And you just have to read on, and God is testing if you'll be patient and let him reveal. And he'll tell you in verse 20, the ram that you saw, Daniel, with the two horns, that represents the kingdom of Media Persia and the two kings. Each horn is one of the kings. And the rough goat or the he-goat that you saw is the king of Grecia or Greece. And the great horn that's between his eyes, that thing you saw there, is the first king. And he's laying this out. And so we got the Medo-Persian Empire as the ram. And what God is doing here is, Daniel, I have to lay out for you, because I know you're excited. We're going to read in the ninth chapter how excited Daniel was to have his people freed. And I need you to know, to let your people know, it's going to be a while, Daniel. I know what you want is you want to set the kingdom up again, but it's going to be a long time before I set up the kingdom of heaven in Israel again. You're going to be under the times of the Gentiles. And what I want to lay out for you now is some history that's going to happen over the next few centuries. And I'm writing history in advance. Now, the first thought I had was, well, you just showed in the seventh chapter that the Medo-Persian Empire was a bear. And you showed that the Grecian Empire was a leopard. And back in the second chapter, the Medo-Persian Empire was the metal of silver. And the Grecian Empire was brass. And why all the change going on here? And God says, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you ahead of time the history that each of those two empires is going to make for themselves before they make history. Explain to me. I'm revealing the future. First off, I wanted to show you about that ram in verse 4. The ram is going to push westward and northward and then southward. And what the Medo-Persian Empire did after they got control is the first thing they did was where they went west and they captured the region of Lydia and Thrace. And then they went northward and they completely conquered all of Babylon and the outlying provinces thereof. And then they gathered their armies together and they went south and they subjugated Egypt. And this was going to happen in the subsequent centuries after they took power. I mean, here they are. They've only been in power for 3 years. It's the third year. And this vision is coming. And well, actually, it's before they've taken power. It's Belshazzar is still in power back then. And they're going to take over in a few years. And before they've even taken power, he's saying, I want to show you ahead of time when they do take power exactly what they are going to do. and he lays out the history of the Persian Empire ahead of time. And he says, and I want to call it a ram. Now, why do you want to call it a ram? Why didn't you just call it what you did back there? You said it was a bear. Why a ram? Well, archaeology has found, subsequently, that the emblem of Persia was a ram. And their kings, when they would go out into battle, and it's not that kings went out into battle all the time. A king went out to battle, like Jesus said, he counts the cost carefully. He doesn't want to go into a battle where he's likely to lose. He goes into a battle where he's going to win. It's kind of like college football. You ever watch college football? You know, a game like where Alabama plays ECC, okay? And you know, and the score is 63-0, and we'll be right back at the second quarter in a moment. What the heck is this all about? I mean, and there are times when one nation overwhelms another, and in things like that, the king would say, let me go out in the front, and I'll put on the royal garb, and as we're coming in and subjugating them, they can see the emblem, they can see my crown, they can see the way I'm dressed. And most kings would wear their crown. The Persian kings would wear a golden ram's head with gemstones on it when leading their armies into battle. They had a religious scroll that was a Zoroastrian scroll that they were very big on, and it's called the Avesta. That's the scroll they would read out of. And in the Avesta, the guardian spirit of the nation of Persia was a ram named Itzad Behram, B-E-H-R-A-M, ram. And he was pictured as two sharp horns with cloven feet. And so God is telling you ahead of time, these are the emblems they're going to pick up. I'm letting you know ahead of time what this nation is going to be known for. Archaeologists have dug up coins, and they found rams on them from Persian coins. Some of them have a Super Bowl, like the Los Angeles Rams, but that's history, and so you won't find that. Now, with the Grecians, the thing that happened to Greece, and they were finally going to grab power about 220-something years after Daniel got this prophecy. He calls them a goat, and it turns out that the national emblem of Greece that they used was a goat, and it was displayed on their Greek coins, which archaeologists have found. The capital city was called the Goat City, and they named it Aegea. And Greek A-G is the word for goat. The nearby waters they called the Aegean Sea or the Goat Sea. The first great king they had, Alexander the Great, married a princess named Roxana, and she used to call her husband the son of a goat, Aegeus, A-E-G-U-S. That was the nickname she had for him, used son of a goat. And so the goat was the emblem for Greece. And so God is laying out centuries ahead, I'm using this symbolism, and I'm telling you what the symbols mean, and they're going to make history that way, and that's exactly what they did. This is history written in advance. That's why the scholars hate the book of Daniel, and what they try to do is say it wasn't written in 550 B.C. It was written in 100 B.C. after all this history was evident, and he was just writing historical accounts. No, he was writing prophecy, and he was given visions from God. And God was calling the end from the beginning. It's a matter as to what you want to believe, whether the scholars or God and his prophet Daniel. So he's laying this thing out. Now, we know who the ram is. We know who the he-goat is. Now, he says in verse 5, as I was considering this he-goat, he came from the west. That's where Greece is. He came on the face of the whole earth. He touched not the ground. This goat had a notable horn between his eyes. The thing we're going to see later on, he's going to call it in verse 8. Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn. The notable horn of verse 5 is known as the great horn of verse 8. Why great? Because it's the first king. And the first great king of the Grecian Empire was Alexander the Great. The great horn. And the horn was a term used for kings. And so God is laying it right out there. He's going to be known as the Great. And it's known as Alexander the Great, the son of Philip of Macedon. Now, Philip of Macedon was a king of Macedonia, which was the beginning form of the Grecian Empire. When he died in 336 BC, his son, who had been born 20 years earlier, was now the king. Alexander was king. Now, Philip was known as a diplomat, and Philip didn't think it was the best thing to go out and start wars because he knew it. Men get killed in wars, resources get used up in wars. He tried to make peace treaties and diplomacy, but his son was a warrior at heart. And as soon as he took the throne at 20, he raised an army with an infantry of 30,000 men and 5,000 cavalrymen, and he roared out of the west, just like Daniel saw here. The sea-goat came out of the west, and he came quickly in what is known as the Blitzkrieg movement, surprise movements. The Germans of World War II learned a lot of their tactics from the tactics of Alexander the Great, found right here in his Blitzkrieg and surprise attacks. And so I guess the Japanese did also with a Pearl Harbor. He comes out of the west roaring toward Persia. Verse 6, he came at the end of the verse in fury. And verse 7, and choler. He was angry. What's he angry about? Well, it turns out Alexander hated the Persians because years before, in the second Persian invasion of Greece, they destroyed the Acropolis in Athens. And that was a historical site of theirs. And when Alexander learned about that as a little boy, you know, little boys want revenge. And it got in his heart, and it brewed up there. And so in Blitzkrieg fashion, immediately he went forward with his 30,000 infantrymen, and he destroyed a Persian division at Granicus, which is quite a bit west of Persia. They were an outlying division there, and he took them apart. And then in Blitzkrieg fashion, he leaped over a waterway like a goat would do and moved swiftly eastward and defeated a large force of 600,000 men commanded by the Persian king Darius. This happened at Issus in 333 BC. At the time, Darius saw his army getting slaughtered by this blitzkrieg, and he fled. And he sent back an embassage and said, look, why don't we sign a peace treaty? Because I know your dad was big on treaties. But Alexander refused, and he sent back a message, said, no, I'm now the new king of Asia. And the following year, he attacked Syria and Tyre. In 331, he conquered Egypt, verse 7. But he came back, came close to the ram, moved with choler again, smote the ram, break the two horns, Media and Persia. There was no power in the ram to stand before him. He cast him down and stamped upon him. From 330 B.C. to 327 B.C., for a 3.5, almost 4-year period, he came with his men, and he subjugated all the outlying remaining provinces of the Persian Empire, both Media and Persia. And he chased Darius, and Darius had to flee the palace. He went into Media. He finally went to Parthia, but Alexander sent men that captured him and took him prisoner and made him pay a large ransom for his wife and his children, but he still kept him in bonds because there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And this is all history. God's just putting it in simple little terms, hundreds of years before it happened. Here it's being written in 538 B.C. This happens in 327 B.C. We're talking 215 years before it occurs, and God's laying it out here. And verse 8, and the he-goat waxed very great, and he captured Babylon. And at the climax of his glory, he set out into India, into the subcontinent of India. He crossed the Indus River. He founded two cities in India. And the whole while he had his armies out there in the east, Greece enjoyed a period of great peace and prosperity. Nobody would dare attack them with Alexander the Great as the head of their nation. During his military campaigns, he would take spoil and booty from the lands and send it back to the capital in Greece and in Athens and Corinth and all those areas. And they vast sums from his conquests stimulated the economy, increased trade across his empire. But then, verse 8, the great horn was broken. And he died. And his life was broken in half. He died at 33 and a half years old. He contracted marsh fever. That, combined with the alcoholism, killed him. And when that happened, he was, this is 323 BC, it says, and up came four notable horns, if you will, notable ones implied horns, toward the four winds of heaven. And upon his death, his four great generals, Cassander, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Ptolemy, you know, looked at this vast empire that he had put together, and they said, why don't we draw lots and straws, and each one of us will take a piece of it. And you can take the west, and you take the east. I'll take the north, and you take the south. And Cassander took Macedonia in the west, and Lysimachus took Thrace in the east, and Seleucus took Syria in the north, and Ptolemy took Egypt in the south. And the Grecian Empire was divided into four kingdoms, just like God said right here, again, 215 years before it occurred. History written in advance. That's what prophecy is. Now, verse 9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great. Toward the south, and toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host, and of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. Yea, he, that would be this little horn of verse 9, magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him, by this little horn, the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Now, this is tricky. And understanding, and I'm not going to say I have perfect understanding. And I've read many of the commentaries, and it is difficult for me too. And one of the reasons you're going to find it's difficult for all of us is verse 16, end of the verse. Well, read the verse. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the river Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. And God's going to dispatch the angel Gabriel to Daniel to give him understanding. But one of the things he's going to say that's key in verse 6:17, so he, that'd be the angel Gabriel, came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid. I fell on my face. But he, the angel, said to me, understand, O son of man. Here it is. For at the time of the end shall be the vision. And what's happening to Daniel is Daniel is being given a vision about the end of the times of the Gentiles. You'd have to go back to Luke chapter 21. And I don't know if you remember Luke 21, but off the top of, I'll just tell you off the top of my head, it's a parallel account of what is known as the Olivet Discourse. And the Olivet Discourse is first recorded for you and for me in the book of Matthew. And that is in Matthew chapter 24. And in that particular chapter, the disciples came to Jesus and they wanted to know when Jesus would reestablish the kingdom of heaven in Israel. And, you know, what's going to be the sign of thy coming and the end of this world, you know, and what time will this be when you come back and reestablish the kingdom? And Jesus began to give them some instruction because he knew this is still going to be 2,000 years away. because I'm just beginning my church, and the church is going to be a two-day project, each day 1,000 years, and it's going to be a ways off. And in Luke 21, they're asking the same question, and you can see, like in verse 10, when he said, nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes in diverse places, and he's giving the same type of answer that he's giving in Matthew, just adding a few more verses to it. And he says, verse 24, and during this period of time of tribulation, they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and they'll be led away captive into all nations. And during this time of the great tribulation, Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And this is the time of the end. And here you and I are living in 2022, December, and we're going to roll into January 2023, and that time still hasn't come. We're still waiting for the trib. Now, we know it's imminent. We know it's coming within the decade, but it's still future to us. Think about what it was to these men in 31 A.D., I mean, it's thousands of years off. And think of what it was to Daniel. Back to where we are in Daniel, I just want to show you why I have trouble interpreting this. We understand in verse 17, it's for the time of the end. Verse 19, he said, behold, Daniel, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. This is when God's finally finished with all the indignation he's put up with. He's not there yet. He's still giving grace. We're still in the age of the church. For the time appointed, the end shall be. God has a time when he's going to appoint this tribulation period, but it's not here yet. Say, well, Mike, why don't you understand it? Well, part of the reason is go to Daniel chapter 12 and look at verse 4. And Daniel's given all this prophecy that troubles him. But thou, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. And the point of the matter is, this, even though it's an open book for us to read, pure and perfect interpretation is sealed till the time of the end. And I'm not hearing the time of the end. It's information on a need-to-know basis. If I were one of Daniel's people living in the time of the end, God's going to open it to them at that time. But right now, the book is still sealed, so I can't get perfect interpretation for you. And nobody can. I'll give you the best I can. So just so you understand my limitations, I'm a Gentile living in the age of grace in the church age. I'm not a Jew living in the time of the end. I don't need to know. I'm not going to be here. I disappear in Revelation 4:1. Those Jews left behind for Revelation chapter 6 through 19, that's the time of the end that we're writing about. They need to know, and God will give. To those who ask, they shall receive. And those that knock, it'll be opened. And those that seek, they'll find. And so I just want you to understand. Now, going back, looking at this, trying to overview it, some things God showed me today that I never saw before, that I taught improperly for years because I followed everyone else's teaching. Not that it's important, we're not going to be here anyways. But looking at it again, going to page one of the notes I gave you, notice on the vision, Roman numeral 2. Notice what's in the vision. A, there's a ram. We understand that. B, there's an he-goat. We understand that. That's Greece. Now watch C and D. C, there's the great horn, and D, there's the little horn. Now, the way it's always been taught is the little horn is a picture of the Antichrist. That's taught in every commentary I have ever read. It's taught by every prophecy guy I've ever heard. I taught it myself. But I never really took the time to teach Daniel before, but the past week or so, I've had to go through this and think and ponder and think and look and ponder and think, and the Lord was, okay, there's a great horn, there's a little horn. Do you think they're both the same? So which is which? The great horn is the Antichrist, and the little horn is the false prophet. Now we're going to see as we, this doesn't matter, we're not going to be here. If you see it another way, doesn't bother me. If I'm wrong, doesn't bother me either. But this is what I've seen in the reading recently, looking at it. What would be some of the confirming things that would make me think that? Alexander the Great was unquestionably a king. We'll call him a king of kings. He was an empire king. This little horn was not a king of kings. And look at his business, this little horn that we're reading about here, picking it up in verses 9, 10, 11, and 12. And notice the business he's occupied with. This little horn, first thing he does, he waxed exceeding great, but it doesn't say how or where, but he went toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Okay, if you follow that from Persia, the south is Egypt. The east is Babylon, and the pleasant land is Israel. And when I think about it, I understand Babylonian false religion, Egyptian physical idolatry, Israel, place of truth. All three involved in religious activities, a religious agenda. Okay, let's continue. Verse 10. He waxed great even to the host of heaven. The host of heaven, the stars. The host of heaven, the heavenly host, angelic beings, the things going on. This is religious activity. Look at, he tries to cast the stars to the ground and stamp on them. Tries to mock certain gods, mock maybe certain angels, mock maybe certain religions, religious stuff. He's not interested in physical things. Verse 11, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host and the daily sacrifice and the place of the sanctuary. These are all religious terms. So it seems to me like the great horn is a portrait. These are portraits being given for the last time. I know there's, you say, well, Brother Mike, the near term obviously was Alexander the Great. True. That was a near term fulfillment of the prophecy with a far term shadow reaching all the way back to the second coming, as we're going to find when Gabriel interprets the vision. We're going all the way to the time of the end. The end has not yet come. And that great horn is a picture of the Antichrist that's to come. And the little horn was involved in the sacrifice. We say, well, that's Antiochus Epiphanes. True. Historically, he came out of one of those four horns. He came out of the horn of Syria. Interestingly, the Syria is close to Israel, and Syria is a spiritual thing. And the false prophet's going to be involved in spiritual things. And go to Revelation chapter 13 and watch the portrait there kind of agree with the great horn being the Antichrist and the little horn being the false prophet. Now, Daniel's given some things here, and we know how closely Daniel lines up with the book of Revelation, because more of the end time prophecy is given to the Apostle John on Patmos. And really, you can't understand Revelation without Daniel. Really, truthfully, you can't understand Revelation without having read the other 65 books of the Bible. I tried that when I was a young Christian. My wife kept trying to correct me, and I was confused because it would say in verse 3, blessed is he that readeth and hear the words of this prophecy. And I said, as long as I have this prophecy, I have enough. But the reality is that's like a capstone built on the other 65 books. And here we are in the 13th chapter. And in this 13th chapter, the kind of visions that Daniel was getting as he's standing on the, verse 1, John is standing on the sand of the sea, and he sees a beast rise up out of the sea with the seven heads and the 10 horns. And this is the vision that Daniel was given in the 7th chapter. And so this is the time of the end. And verse 2, and the beast which I saw was like the leopard. And the feet were the feet of the bear, and the mouth of the lion, and the dragon, and the very things that Daniel saw in the 7th chapter. So you can see them all tying together. And then I saw One of his heads wounded to death, and the deadly wound was healed, and the world wondered after the beast. And this is the Antichrist himself when he goes through that period of death, and God allows him to have a false resurrection. And all the way through the next number of verses, we're reading about that beast who is the Antichrist. Verse 6, and he opens his mouth in blasphemy against God. And verse 7, it's given to him, this Antichrist, to make war with the saints. And these are the Jewish saints living in that time, and overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And verse 8, and all that dwell on the earth shall worship him. And the Antichrist is receiving worship. And then, verse 11, and I beheld another beast coming out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb. He spake as a dragon, and he exercises all the power of the first beast. And he causes all the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, the one whose deadly wound was healed. And this other beast, who's the false prophet, can do great wonders. And he can make fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by means of the miracles which he had the power to do. And he says to everyone on the earth, hey, let's make an image to the beast, to the Antichrist, the one who had a wound by a sword and live. And he's going to get worship going. His sphere is religion. The Antichrist's sphere is government. And it's back to the Tower of Babel. There is a city with governmental power, and there is a tower with religion. And God knows the two legs of society are government and religion. And the great horn is the first beast, the Antichrist, and the little horn is the second beast, the false prophet, and they come together and they do their work to take over all the poor people on the earth and get them to follow them, the Pied Pipers, leading them right down into the ditch of destruction. And here it is. So back to where we are in Daniel 8, as I'm looking at it, this is how I'm beginning to see it. The little horn is involved in a religious agenda. Verse 12, the host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression and cast down the truth to the ground. And the main thing he's going to do is all the warnings that were given in the Bible back in Deuteronomy chapter 13. And we were just reading Revelation chapter 13 and Deuteronomy chapter 13. Remember, the Jews are going to be reading the books of Moses. And they're going to be reading this, and it's saying, if there arise among you a prophet, Jesus said, let no man deceive you. And here's the false prophet trying to deceive everyone. Here's the Christ. Here's the Christ. This is not the Christ. That's the Antichrist. And the 13th chapter of Deuteronomy is to watch out with these prophets. Hearken not to the words of the prophet that will turn you after other gods. Let us go after other gods which thou hast not known, and let us serve them. And that's exactly what's going on. And the little horn is doing this. 1 John chapter 4, beloved, try the spirits. There are many false prophets gone out into the world. And this is the little horn, is the false prophet. Now back to where we were in Daniel 8, as I was getting this thought, I'm reading, and Daniel now has the full prophecy, and he's seen the ram, Medo-Persia. He's seen the he-goat, Greece. He saw the notable great horn come and destroy the Medo-Persians, which happened with Alexander the Great. He saw the four horns come up and one come out of them that had more of an interest in the daily sacrifice and the truth and the sanctuary than he did in governmental power. That's the little horn. And verse 13, as he's seeing the vision, he hears some voices. And he says, and I heard one saint speaking. And then another saint said to that certain saint, which spake, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host, how long will they be trodden underfoot? And he said to me, well, 2,300 days, and then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And he hears these two voices speaking. And a couple things I learned from looking at it is, the first thing I learned was it obviously can't be the near-term prophecy of Antiochus doing what we spoke of last week when he, let's say, put the pigs on the altar back in 170 B.C., and then Judas Maccabee and his armies fought and drove them out, and they cleansed the sanctuary, and they had the rededication of Hanukkah, and I would think that would be it. But the truth of the matter is, back to where I'm verse 13, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation? Well, they didn't have the abomination of desolation and that transgression at that time. So this is going all the way to Revelation 13. There's a gap in the prophecy. And this is something I don't like. I'm sorry, but God puts these gaps in his Bible in key places. We're going to catch a real big one in the next chapter. That will be Daniel chapter 9, between verse 26 and 27 is a 2,000-year gap between one verse. Jesus will do the same thing in his reading of Isaiah 61. In the middle of verse 2, there'll be 2,000 years right in the middle of the verse. God does the same thing in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and then there's 2,000 years, and then the earth is without form and void, and there's a gap. And God does this every so often. I wish he wouldn't do it, but he does it. Is it important if you know? No. Learn that Jesus is the Christ. Get saved and help someone get saved, and we'll all go to school in the millennium, and we'll learn all these deeper things. But God puts these gaps here, and there's another gap hidden in verse 13. Not surprised about it, because in verse 14, it'll be 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Well, it didn't take that long for them to cleanse a sanctuary when Antiochus did his work. They cleansed that thing up in 8 days during the time of the Hanukkah. So what's this? This has to do with the Great Tribulation, and this has to do with the cleansing then. Now, not that it matters, but if you've studied the book of Revelation, you find out that it's 7 years, and we'll learn that again in Daniel 9, and it's a 42-month period of the first half and a 42 months of the second half. And when they abominate and desolate the thing, 42 months is 1,260 days. This is 2,300. Our accountant friends will tell us this is 1,048 days beyond the 42 months. So my only thought is that application must be in the book of Ezekiel and Acts chapter 15. This is not important. Don't worry about it. But after the tribulation, when Jesus comes back and cleans up the earth and then rebuilds the temple, it's going to take him apparently this long before the temple is ready for its rededication. Not that it matters. What was curious to me is in verse 13, I heard one saint speak to another saint. Now all the commentaries say those are angels. I heard it. I heard it in the back. Somebody said it. One of you got it. Did I just hear one of you name names back there? Go. Who'd I hear? What'd you say? It's Moses and Elijah. It's Moses and Elijah. It came to me today like a flash of light. It just lit right up. That's Moses and Elijah. Did you remember the Mount of Transfiguration? In the book of, got to go to Luke. Luke chapter 9. And Jesus here, after Peter makes the great confession in verse 20, we'll close it here. Next week I have more for you. You don't mind if we go another hour on this chapter. There's stuff in here. And plus, God gave me another possible revelation as to what the chapter means, as to how the Antichrist will start the war, World War III, in this chapter. And I'll share that with you. We'll see. Not important. But here, Luke chapter 9, verse 18, when Jesus asked the disciples, you know, who do they say that I am? And then verse 20, Peter says, thou art the Christ of God. And this is chapter 16 of Matthew retold here in Luke's gospel. And then verse 21, Jesus charged them, tell no man this thing. Because, now why don't you want me to tell people you're the Christ? Why? Exactly, because I'm not dealing with lost, stupid Gentiles like the ones in Grace and Truth Church, okay, who don't know anything. And it's not your fault. We didn't grow up with a Bible. How many of you grew up with a Bible? How many of you grew up with that book in your hands? Unless you grew up with grandparents or parents that knew the book, you grew up with a newspaper in your hands, a comic book in your hands, something by Hugh Hefner in your hands. I mean, you had something else in your hands. You didn't have a Bible. Don't kid me. Don't kid me. I grew up in America. You're not lying to me. Okay, so we don't know anything. But Jesus isn't in America. He's in Israel. He's in a land that has the temple standing and has kids, Jewish kids that go to synagogue and have grown up with all the stories that you and I didn't know. And his thought was, all in that Old Testament, it testifies of me. And now I'm here. And now when I meet them, I want them to look at me and listen to me and go, oh my goodness, this is the fulfillment of what it says in the book. Just like Peter did. You're the Christ. I remember those stories as a little boy. You're the one Isaiah wrote about. Yeah, exactly, Peter. And you got it. And you got it because you thought on it, and my Father helped you get it, and I want every one of them to come to a personal revelation of who I am. Not just repeating some words on a card, well, you're the Christ. No, I want it to be my Father showing them. So you don't tell any of these people. They've read enough Bible to know. Now, we're in America. It's different. We got to tell them that's the Christ. What does that mean? Well, let me show you. And we have to take the time. So, verse 22, then he reveals to his men, he says, by the way, the Son of Man's going to suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and I'll be slain, but I'll be raised again the third day. And then he goes on and he says, now, if you want to be my disciple and you want to come after me, you got to deny yourself. You got to take up your cross daily and follow me. It's going to be a labor of love. You're going to be going against the whole world when you do this thing. And whosoever will save his life shall lose it. You just want to save your old life, you're going to lose that. But you lose your life for my sake, you're going to save it for all of eternity. What is a man advantaged if he gains the whole world and loses himself or is cast away? Whosoever shall be ashamed of me and my words of him, shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his own glory and in his Father's glory and in the glory of the holy angels. And I'll tell you a truth, there be some of you standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the kingdom of God. In verse 28, it came to pass about 8 days after these sayings, he took Peter and John and James, and he went up into a mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered, and his raiment was white and glistering. And they're watching, if you will. They're having a vision, just like Daniel's having a vision. It's a heavenly vision of what the kingdom of heaven is like and the kingdom of God is like. And you know what goes on in the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of God? You've got saints, and the saints are talking, and they ain't talking idle words. They're talking about God and his Son and his plans and his work, and that's what they talk about. And there's Moses and Elijah. And they appeared in glory, and they speaking about Jesus and his decease, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem. And everything we're reading here is in preparation for the second coming. And these are second coming plans. And here we hear Moses and Elijah, and they're talking about all these things. And they're saying, look, we watched him die on the cross, and we know he's coming back. And we know when he comes back, he's going to reestablish the temple, and he's going to cleanse it after 2,300 days, and the sanctuary will be cleansed. And they're all excited about this second coming. And they're talking back and forth about it. And Daniel got a chance to overhear for a moment. You know what the saints of God talk about? The things of God, and the work of God, and the Son of God, and the plans of God, and the words of God. And that's what they got a chance as they heard those voices. And then next week we'll look more at the visitation and the interpretation. We're out of time. Yes, question in the back.